Love isn't what it used to be, and it hasn't necessarily changed for the better. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 7 minutes after 6 on Thursday, June 28th. My guest this hour is Ava Illouz. She's professor of sociology at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and her newest book is Why Love Hurts. She joins us by phone from Jerusalem. Ava Illouz, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here.
Now, first of all, I want to start with a basic concept of your book. I think a lot of us think that love and a lot of other things in the world are fixed. They're the same through history. When we say love, we say mean the same thing that someone in the 19th century did, or maybe even someone in ancient Greece did. Is love a fixed commodity?
Well, you know, as many things like food, it is and it is not. We have always eaten, and yet the ways in which we present our food, the very kind of vegetables we grow, have varied through time. So we can think of emotions in the same way. There perhaps is a common core to many of them, but how we feel them actually varies quite a bit. So we would not think that the courtly love of the 12th century in France, where a man could worship a woman for 12 years or 10 years without having sex, we would not recognize this as a valid or healthy form of love. And yet, we would still identify with some of the poetry that was written at the time. So not only is the feeling of love itself changeable, but how it hurts also changed, and this is what I try to document in this book. I'm not saying it hurts more or less. I'm saying it hurts differently than in the past.
And let's get the modern state of the art. How does love hurt today?
Well, let me go through this quickly. Think of the search. We're going to think about four aspects. One is the search for a mate. The search has become extraordinarily long and complicated. You are faced with a vast amount of potential choices. In the past, the search was fairly limited in time, in geography, in social class, religion, ethnicity. So, of course, we wouldn't want that. We wouldn't want to be in a situation where we would be severe, you know, Romeo and Juliet, where you have to either die or not marry the person of your choice. But that means that we have new conditions where the search itself has become an exhausting, complicated process. This is what Sex and the City, for example, I think expresses. The fact that the very search for a partner has become quite complicated and difficult and even agonizing for many people in the world. Two, take commitment. Commitment used to be also a fairly simple affair. We now have a moral panic we've been having for 20, 30 years, a moral panic around the issue of commitment, and it seems to only increase with time. Commitment phobia of men, it started with the commitment phobia of men, and now it is increasingly both genders who are plagued by the difficulty of knowing what their feelings are or of committing themselves, wanting to commit to a long relationship. Three, think of relationships themselves. They seem to be quite often a constant haggling and bargaining about your possibility of satisfying my needs, my psychological needs. This is also something that didn't exist in the past. Of course, couples always fought, but they didn't fight about something that has become much more essential, and it is the fact that you do not provide me with enough recognition, enough validation of my being, that you're not telling me all the time or quite often how wonderful a human being I am. This is something I have not found evidence for in the past. And finally, when people are left, and when relationships end, there is a sense in which it is their basic sense of self-worth that is crushed and annihilated. Again, in a way that did not exist in the past. You could suffer because your lover had left you or had died, but you did not have the sense that it was your very identity and what you are worth as a human being that was at stake. So these are very broadly, the four ways in which how love hurts has changed.
We'll dig deeper into each of those points through this hour. You're listening to Ava Illouz. She's author of Why Love Hurts. Interested in hearing your perspective this hour at 800-642-1234. What changes have you seen in romance in your lifetime? How did things work differently, say, for your generation and your children's generation, or vice versa, yours versus your parents? Do you think that romance will improve in the future? How? And why? And what about the dating market? How weird is that? 800-642-1234, or you can email talk@wpr.org. Ava Luz, there are some fundamental changes going on behind those four things you just talked about. I'd like to move in on a couple of them. One thing that linked the four things you just said was it seems like a lot of our sense of who we are, our identity, is bound up in relationships and love more maybe than it used to be. Is that right?
Absolutely. You got it just right. Again, I want to stress that these difficulties have to do with changes that we all welcome. So when we all lived in highly hierarchical societies, the sense of self-worth was tied to our social class. You knew what you were worth, and everybody knew, and you knew that everybody knew. So this was not something negotiable. You did not negotiate what you were worth.
If I'm a peasant, I'm a peasant. And
exactly.
That's it.
Exactly. And the second thing is that I don't think we quite realize how much we live in a society of evaluation. Perhaps more than anything else, this is what characterizes our society. It is the fact that we are constantly evaluated. Even our children evaluate our performance as parents. This is why they end up sometimes with psychologists talking about how their parents did or did not do. Because we are so constantly evaluated in all walks of life, love represents the possibility, the promise, that we're going not only to stop being evaluated, but also that we will outwin all the others in this evaluation. When someone loves us, it means we have outperformed the others. And that gives us a sense of security, of stability, that we have very little today in modern society. That is why, in many ways, love is both more difficult and more necessary to our sense of security and stability.
Are we developing ways to develop more of that sense of security and stability independently of a relationship, of the pursuit of love?
I think that I think the workplace, if we were in very stable and secure and rewarding workplaces, which provided us with a very abundant recognition, or if we lived in communities in which there was a clear sense of the worth of our work in that community, I think either of these two things could be a very good alternative to the sense of security that love provides. But we don't. We don't have those very rewarding, richly rewarding workplaces, and we don't have those thick communities that can give us a sense of purpose and meaning. This is why romantic love seems to be the default on which most of us fall.
And one point I definitely want to get to during this hour, you talk about the way that we take our failures in love or our shortcomings in love as something wrong with us. If we haven't found the perfect partner, the perfect spouse by age X or by our childbearing years or something like that, what's wrong with me is the question. It's bigger than us. Is that right?
It is absolutely right. You put it just extremely well. You know, look at, for example, Jane Austen, Sense and Sensibility, very well-known novel. Marianne is courted by Willoughby, and she is led to think, and everyone else around her is led to think, that he is interested in her and he's going to propose, because this is what you did at that time. You do not behave in such a way as to give the impression that you're going to that your intentions do not match your emotions. So we discover later that he's in fact actually already engaged. He leaves her. And what is interesting in the novel is that Marianne is crushed, but she never has the sense that herself is not worthy. In fact, not only she does not have this sense, but the person who bears the blame very clearly is Willoughby himself. And she not only views him as blameworthy, but everyone around her is completely outraged. Take today. What would happen in such a case? I was overwhelmed by my findings that when I interviewed men and women, I found that when women were left, in fact, they felt overwhelmingly responsible, secretly responsible for having been left. They tell themselves, I was not, something in me was not good enough. Had I had the right psyche, I would have known to keep this guy. So not only we do not have anymore, and perhaps, again, it's a good thing too, we do not have a moral language to condemn a person that courts us or elicits feelings in us without intending to follow suit. We don't have that moral language anymore because we think everyone is free to do as they want at any point in any relationship. But also we have become used to think that the problems we have, the failures we have, especially in intimate relationships, are the result of faulty or deficient psyches. So maybe I love him too much, or maybe I'm afraid of intimacy, therefore I pick the wrong men. These are failure psychological ways of thinking, which, in fact, have made us learn the art of blaming ourselves when something does not work out.
Ava Alouz is the author of Why Love Hurts. We're talking about love, why it hurts, and why it's different than it used to be, say, in the 19th century and beyond. We'll get to your calls and a lot more, including maybe self-help and fear of commitment, through the rest of the hour. You can join the show at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Are our standards of love impossible? Do you see them changing over the years? Give a call, 800-642-1234. The weather is a little easier to predict than love, and today it'll be sunny and hot, a few passing clouds, and a chance of rain mainly in the south, highs ranging from 85 up to 98. There's a heat advisory in effect from noon till 6 today for much of southern and east central Wisconsin. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy, chance of rain in the southwest, lows 58 to 72. Tomorrow, hot and sunny, a slight chance of rain in the far southwest, highs in the 80s and low 90s, lows in the 60s and low 70s. It'll stay hot out beyond that as well. Looking at current temperatures, Milwaukee 77, Green Bay 73, Appleton 74, Eau Claire 74, Wausau 70, Superior 72. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine this week here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're asking the question, what is love anyway, and how does it change over time? How has it changed over time? My guest is Ava Alouz. She is author of Why Love Hurts. We'll get to your calls now. Joey joins us in Patch Grove. Hi, Joey.
Hi, how you doing? Apparently I'm becoming a frequent caller here. Yeah, I have a few theories on why love these days doesn't work, including media and societal views, societal pressures more. I believe that, in my opinion, that too many people nowadays, I'm 32, so a lot of people in my generation, younger, are looking for that romantic, what they see in movies, that instant connection, the love at first sight, and the, happily ever after ending. And they want it so bad that they feel that, somebody they meet and have an instant connection with, this is going to be the one. They don't take the time out to get to know each other. I also believe societal views have a big impact on that as well. Your friends, if you're a single person, they're always telling you, you got to go out and look for somebody. I have a lot of friends who often tell me that I need to have somebody in my life, and often label me as lonely because I am alone.
Do you feel lonely? I don't want to get all self-helpy here, but how do you feel about that, Joey?
Well, yeah, if you're alone after a certain point of time, I've been single for like 5 years, and there are times where it gets, you do get slight little feelings of being, lonely. But after a little bit of time, if you try to look on the bright side of things and you try to get past that and don't let it drag you down, you do get over it quite quickly. And I've come to believe that, I'm happy with myself. And I've got, I'd rather be alone than with the wrong person.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot, Joey. I want to get a response from Ava Eluz now. Ava, exactly what we were just talking about, how our self-esteem, our self-image is bound up with our relationship or lack of same. What do you think about that?
Well, I would like to react to this caller. I thought he said some very important things.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
One is that we know that single households are the fastest growing household, type of household, both in the U.S. and in Europe. And in fact, I think there are more single households today in the U.S. than they are households composed of many people living together. And yet, we hold a negative view, as this caller suggested very well, that we hold a negative view of single people. So one of the things I think we're lacking and we're moving toward are positive models of single life. One of the things that has happened, I think, in the last, 30, 40 years or perhaps more, is not only that love is viewed as the ideal life, but also we have, again, these psychological models of intimacy that tell us if you're not in an intimate relationship, something is wrong and deficient with you. And I think we should move away from these models. At least we should be more pluralistic about the kind of mental health or valid models of existing. We should not make intimacy the condition for living well. And this is one of the things I heard him say. The second thing I heard him say, and this is something that is said very often, it is about the influence of media on shaping unrealistic expectations about love. This was true, I would say, in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. I don't think it is true anymore because many movies, in fact, have a completely incorporated a kind of irony about the formula of romantic love. I mean, you even remember in, that famous movie with Julia Roberts and Richard Gere.
Pretty Woman.
Pretty Woman, of course, at the end of the woman, at the end of the movie, the movie says, Hollywood, this is Hollywood, just to remind you, this is a fable and that you should not really believe in it too much. And in fact, one of the things that characterizes many people today is that they anticipate to be disappointed. The anticipation of disappointment or the very idea that we have unrealistic ideas of love is the most widespread cliche of love we have today. It's a very, very common idea. So that adolescents already learn very early on, they learn two things. Both how to long for these prototypes and how to be very suspicious of them. So we have these two things. This is why we want to believe, but we can never quite believe in it. So we are not living in a romantic era. We are living in a post-romantic era in that sense.
Thanks for the call. I think Mark from Lake Geneva has something on this very subject. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call and welcome to your guest. I would have to read your book in full to fully comment on it, but I have the belief that the media has a far greater portrayal on love and our society's view on it. I believe the love songs that we listen to, the stories, the general narrative is that it's this massive rush, this infusion of passion, and that's going to be lifelong. Rather than the momentary thing that introduces us to the possibility of love. And love is a longer-term overview, and it then includes later family and friends and other things. But yet our narrative that our society tells us, again, through the songs, through our books, through our movies, through our television shows, is that it's this cutesy, whimsical, passionate, bam, and it's going to be that way all the time.
Great. Thanks for the call, Mark. Just a couple of minutes till news. Ava Eluz, is there a conflict between our concepts of falling in blissful love and then the year-to-year reality of being in a relationship?
Yes and no. This is, of course, a widespread idea. But there is nothing, when you think of it, that should really prevent us from moving from the state of passionate love to the state, to the quiet state of attachment. What does prevent us, and I completely agree with the caller, but I simply would like to add something, are two important things. It is how we interpret the attachment, the stage in which we move to the quiet and secure attachment. There are two main things that threaten that stage and which do not have to do with media representations, but rather with what is happening in society at large. One is choice. There is far more choice today than there ever was, choice of partners. And so that, you know, up until, I would say, especially with Viagra, men's sexuality has been considerably extended in time. And so men and women as well view their active sexual life as has been extremely extended. And they view their life with possible sexual and romantic partners as being open-ended. So that's one thing. It's the incredible increase of possible choice. The second thing is excitement, the importance of an exciting of excitement and of an exciting sexuality, which are new definitions of what a good life is. And the importance of excitement makes us view attachment and daily life as being quite dull and meaningless. And so it's not the media as such. It is what is around the media. It is, for example, the culture of excitement that comes attached with a culture of consumption.
I'm going to jump in there. Eva Illouz is our guest. She's author of Why Love Hurts, a sociologist in Jerusalem. We're talking about love, relationships, how they've changed over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network. The news is next. Love hurts. Love scars. Talking about love and why it hurts and how it feels and hurts differently than it used to. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine this week here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 6:36 on this Thursday morning. My guest is Eva Illouz. She is author of Why Love Hurts. And you can join in with your thoughts. Why does love hurt today, and how is it different than it used to be? Have relationships and romance changed from your parents' decade to your own? 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Back to the phones now with Tim in Green Bay. Hi, Tim.
Good morning. My question was about trust and commitment, and Eva's last comment about men and sexuality and experiencing, and it seems nowadays a lot of women like to go that route. They are, like my former partner would, she stayed in touch with her old partner and still celebrated birthdays and sex and enjoyed stuff like that, and she experienced sex with her other partners in the hospital at work just felt that was just normal, or I should accept that, but without really being clear that's what her practice is.
Gotcha. Might get a little too personal there, but how have our attitudes toward what a commitment in a relationship mean, how's that changed, Eva Illouz?
Well, it's a very good question, and of course it goes to the heart of one of the problems that we are facing today. It used to be the case that our relationship to the loved one was modeled after our relationship to God. I would say that's one of the meanings of monogamy. Monogamy is like monotheism. You're allowed to have only one God. You're allowed to have only one partner. That has drastically changed. Doesn't mean that there are no people who are monogamous. Many of them are still monogamous, and we still uphold that as a very dear value. But in conditions of a very large choice, as I said before, the sense of being able to commit to only one person is fading away. And one of the things that we observe is that there is some of the logic that is at work in consumer choice that becomes operative also in romantic choice. So you're afraid of missing out on a better opportunity. That's why you want to keep out your options always open. This expression, in fact, suggests that you do not want to commit yourself by and thereby miss out on something that might come along that is better. So choice has changed not only in the sheer number of people who are available to us, but also what it has changed is our capacity to really commit ourselves only to one single person. And also what choice does is that it blunts our feelings. It makes them, in fact, less intense and less focused, because choice seems, and this is also something we can see from consumer choice, the more choice we have, the less able we are to make up our mind on one single object, the less committed we are to one single object, and the more ambivalent we become. Ambivalence means a state of confusion and an inability to know exactly where you stand and what you want. So this I would view as having changed the conditions for commitment. Ambivalence and the desire to keep our options always open, the desire to maximize our options, this is what choice means, and the incapacity to commit oneself.
Now, we talk in terms of consumer choice, as you just did, a dating market, maximizing our options. This sounds like a capitalist way of looking at love and relationships. Is that the case?
Well, look at the internet dating sites. The internet dating sites are a fairly interesting phenomenon, because if in daily life, let's say before the internet era, you never really see the number of partners who you are going to meet. These are always imagined and potential, but they are never there. Where, on the other hand, on the internet, they're all laid out in front of you as if they were on a buffet. You see suddenly all the market of possible choices. And what happens? You start comparing between the different options, and you start ranking the different people, because by measuring people, by giving them a number, this is the easiest way we have to process the mass of information that people lay out for us. So in ranking people, in giving them a grade, what you actually do is that you commodify them. And so that's one way in which, indeed, it is laid out for us as if it was on a market much more than in the past, and bizarrely so, because we used to think of the past as being more rational than we are. But I think, in fact, our rationality is far more elaborate and intense than that of the past. And then the second way in which we can see this market mentality is, as I said a while ago, is that it encourages people to want to maximize their option. Maximization is a term that economists use as opposed to optimization. Optimization is what you do when you settle for the first good enough choice. This is what people tended to do in the past. When they had an offer of marriage, if it was good enough, satisfying enough, they took it. I think we have moved to a maximizing mentality where we want always to make sure that we are improving our choice and that we are not only improving but getting the best we can. So in that sense, I would say that we are now far more economic creatures when looking for a romantic partner than we may have been in the past.
But as you alluded to earlier, the more we think we can maximize our choice, the more we think there might be something better out there, ultimately that can lead to no choice if we always think that we could do better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That leads to apathy, actually. That could lead to apathy and to the fact that some people compulsively get into one relationship after another and seem to be unable to settle on one single person. You're absolutely right.
The scary thing is this really reminds me of shopping for a light fixture last night. But we're not talking about lights. We're talking about love and relationships with Ava Illouz. She's a professor of sociology in Jerusalem. She's author of the new book, Why Love Hurts. Questions for her or your thoughts on why love works or doesn't work in modern-day America. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. How do you see it changing through the generations, from your parents' time to yours, your time to your children's? 800-642-1234. Have you tried online dating? How did that make you feel? You can call 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Ava Illouz, getting back to popular culture, it seems like a lot of what you're talking about choice and the market, is summed up in TV shows, from game shows like The Dating Game way back in the day up to The Bachelor and The Bachelorette today. Are those good, I guess, metaphors for what we're actually encountering in our daily lives?
Yes, completely. I think you hit it just right. This is not something I wrote in my book, but I would say that The Bachelor, for example, is a metaphor for the fact that we are faced all the time with the question of how am I going to know that this is the person that is meant for me. So first, we are faced with a large number of possibilities. Second, notice that these possibilities are not constrained by race or by religion. And again, it's a great thing. Three, these possibilities are large. And because they are large, they're often, it means we have more difficulties making up our mind. And fourth, we are, along with that process of evaluating quite coldly someone, then we still hope that in the end, the big love is going to be found. So one of the things that interests me in this study is to look at the set of tensions and conflicts and contradictions we set up for ourselves when we believe that there is a one and only, when we believe that only chemistry decides, when we believe that love is irrational and spontaneous, on the one hand, but on the other hand, we set up these shows, these programs, these technologies, which force us, so to speak, to constantly evaluate, compare, and weigh pros and cons, and so to behave as rational creatures. This set of tensions and their sharpness and acuity are modern, in my opinion.
Ava Illouz, author of Why Love Hurts. We'll take your calls at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, coming up after the break, or talk@WPR.org. And coming up after the break, I'll get into an issue we haven't really touched yet. How does this affect women differently from men? Looking at the weather right now, sunny and hot today. A few passing clouds, a chance of rain, mainly in the south. Highs 85 to 98. A heat advisory will be in effect from noon until 6 today for much of southern and east central Wisconsin. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy, a chance of rain in the southwest, lows 58 to 72. Tomorrow, hot and sunny. A slight chance of rain in the far southwestern part of the state. Right now, Milwaukee 77 degrees, Green Bay 73, Madison 80, La Crosse 78, Superior 72 degrees. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 7, ask not what your country can do for you. When in the course of human events, 47 years ago, I have a dream. Some of the words that have moved, changed the United States, that have reverberated throughout the decades and in some cases centuries since they were spoken or written. I'll talk about the American Bible with author Stephen Prothero. This hour, we are talking about love with Ava Illouz. She is the author of Why Love Hurts, talking about how love has changed. Relationships have changed over the years, often because of forces way beyond our control. We're talking about why that is and how that works. Ava Illouz, one big point that you talk about is how this all affects women differently than men. We could have spent the whole hour, honestly, just on that. But give us some of the highlights or lowlights. How is this different for women than men?
Well, there are many points, as you said. I'm just going to give you one. The family used to be something that both men and women wanted because men wanted to propagate their names, And to live in a patriarchal society meant you could control a woman, children, servants, and a plot of land. And often the family was the main economic operation in many people's lives because they didn't have a capitalist market. And so you joined your economic assets with that of another. So the family was crucial socially both to men and women in that sense. When they met on the marriage market, they were equal. They were emotional equal. They both wanted it, and everyone knew they both wanted it. In conditions of capitalism, the family becomes superfluous to masculinity. Now, masculinity, what it needs is to succeed in economic organizations, and it needs to supervise or to control people in economic organizations. The family has become emotional. It's not a place really where you affirm your power and masculinity. Not anymore. It used to be, but not anymore. Now, this means that for men, the family is not, or wanting children, or the family is not something they want or they want early. My analysis suggests that for those women who are not lesbian and who still subscribe to the heterosexual model or injunction that they be mothers, what happens then is that it is the social role of women of wanting children and of wanting them faster and more than the men. So what happens? When they meet, the woman is going to be much more conscious of her age. The woman is going to be much more conscious of her reproductive capacities. And you add to that something else, which is that the samples from which men can choose are much larger, because men can choose younger women, and they can choose women who are of a lower socioeconomic status than they themselves are, because they count more on their earnings. So all of this together suggests that men and women are now meeting in conditions of emotional inequality, where the men can afford, so to speak, not to commit, or not to commit fast, or to wait much longer before committing himself. And that's because their basic relationship to this thing we call the family and to having children has changed.
And that's a huge fault line under the foundation of relationships nowadays. And you can't have a conversation with someone about their love life or watch a sitcom or a romantic comedy movie without hearing something about how, you know, women want commitment, men have are commitment phobic, they have a fear of commitment.
Exactly. But I think it does not have to do, for example, we've been taught to accept this state by, explaining it through biology. And I don't think it is biology. I don't think that men are actually less capable of commitment, love, or enduring affection than women. I mean, not only do we explain this with biology, but we have also learned to pathologize men. What many of these sitcoms do is that they're using a cliche about men's psyche as being pathological because it is deficient in their capacity to love and to sustain love. I don't think that's the case at all. I think that what has changed are these objective conditions of choice. Men have simply more choice objectively than women. Therefore, they are behaving in ways that make them stall their choice and their commitment. That's all what commitment is. The commitment is the capacity to say, I am getting out of this situation of endless choice. And because society has set up so much more choice for men than for women, this is what makes men more reluctant to enter and remain in stable relationships.
So it's not men's biology, and it's not their psychological failures. It's just the society we live in.
Exactly, which is in a way more distressing, because these are more difficult things to change. On the other hand, I think if we stop blaming men for their pathologies, and if we start thinking about valid models of masculinity, which do not exclude commitment, which associate as in the 19th century, you know, which associate masculinity with the capacity to make up your mind, to be steadfast and to be passionate about your emotions and romantic choices, I think maybe we could see some change. So we should stop pathologizing, and we should think more collectively about valid models of masculinity that praise commitment and passion.
Time for another call from Michael in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Michael.
Yes, hi. I'm sorry I didn't catch this topic earlier. It's a wonderful topic. In fact, I'm just learning about it at UW in my psychology course. But I had a professor who was talking about this similar thing last week who indicated that roles between males and females are actually switching, and men are becoming more feminine in the way that they take care of things and doing more domestic work, and just in the general role, the gender roles between male and female are becoming very blurred in the domestic setting between husbands and wives, and actually that women prefer that over the men who used to have the traditional role of being the worker and the more aggressive, the more, and I was just wondering how your guest felt about that, because I was very surprised to hear my professor talk about this actually for quite a while, that this was something that was being very common.
Ava Luz, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think I would agree. I would say, though, that it is probably dependent on education. I think the education would be probably the crucial variable predicting whether men are going to do household tasks with the women. I mean, there are still important divisions. There are also findings that suggest that women have not worked less. If anything, you know, they have been working more because the standards also are going up. But there is something that we can call an androgenization of men and women. Androgen meaning that both men and women have taken on properties of the other gender. Women are far more assertive and out in the world, and men are far more emotional and caring. This is certainly a tendency that we see. That doesn't mean that they are more able or better able to commit themselves. On the contrary, I would say some of these men are actually have a very high value in the market and probably do not settle easily because they are more sensitive or more willing to share household tasks with women.
Just a minute and a half left for a big question. What is your hope for the future of modern romance, and are you optimistic for our society?
You know, I don't think so much in pessimistic or optimistic terms. What I think is important for us is to describe problems accurately. And I think we have described them too much as problems that derive from psychology. And it is of course the case that some people have serious psychological problems. Of course, I do not want to deny that. But a lot of our private lives are also shaped by pressures that come from the capitalist market, from the workplace. And if we become aware of those forces, then we might be able to start rethinking them in ways that will help us more effectively.
That's a good place to leave it. Ava Illouz, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
That was Ava Illouz. She's a professor of sociology at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and we've been talking about her new book, Why Love Hurts. Coming up next hour, the American Bible, an effort to pull together some of the main texts, the most important words in American history, things we have been debating over and will continue to debate throughout the years. Also today, lots of coverage of the Supreme Court's impending healthcare decision. 10 o'clock with John Munson, 4 o'clock at Issue with Ben Marins. Tomorrow at 7 o'clock, we'll get a bunch of responses here on the morning program. Thanks to Amanda Magnus and Naya Mukherjee for producing this hour. I'm Rob Verrett. I'm filling in for Joy Cardine this week, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.